Hi, good afternoon, everyone. My name is Ben Bland. I'm a research fellow at the Lowy Institute. I just want to start by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land on which we meet today, the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, and pay my respects to their elders past, present, and emerging. I'm delighted today to have Pat Cox here with us. He's a veteran of the European Parliament, the European Union, 8 Irish referenda on Europe-related questions. So he's really the perfect person to be talking to us today about the EU and Ireland after Brexit. So Pat is currently the president of the Jean Monnet Foundation for Europe, an independent research organization based in Switzerland, which supports the drive for European unity. Pat's an Irish national. He's a former parliamentarian in Ireland and in the European Parliament, where he was president of the European Parliament, and he entered politics after a distinguished career in broadcasting and academia. He's long been a proponent of European integration, and today we're going to be talking about how that project can move forward without the UK. So I'm going to grill Pat for about 30 or 40 minutes today, and then I'm going to open up to your questions for about 15 or 20 minutes at the end. Before we get into the Q&A, I just want to start with a bit of context, because things in my mother country, the UK, have been somewhat confusing over the last few years. And when we planned this event, the UK was actually meant to have already Brexited. But the 31st of October hard deadline came and went, like so many other deadlines, and Brexit limbo continues, as I'm sure you all know. The UK is now facing a potentially decisive election on December the 12th. If Prime Minister Boris Johnson wins, he's going to push for his withdrawal agreement and likely begin negotiations on a future relationship with the EU around a trade agreement and quite a large separation from the organisation. If the opposition Labour Party in the UK wins, we could see a second referendum potentially. And if the very small Liberal Democrat Party wins, which is highly unlikely, they're promising a unilateral cancellation of Brexit. So, Pat, I think the first question I need to ask you is, how likely is it that Brexit actually happens?
Well, I think the scenario you just presented kind of answers the question more than handsomely. The new Speaker was elected in the House of Commons last week, and he will retain his seat. And then there are 649 other seats, which are each microcosms of the larger contest. And in Britain today, because the traditional weightiness of the Conservative Party and the Labour Party have been challenged to some degree in the opinion polls by Nigel Farage and the Brexit Party on one side, and by this alliance that has grown now between the Liberals, Plaid Cymru and the Greens in non-Scotland UK, and then the strength of SNP in Scotland, it makes this election especially hard to predict. I've watched people who know it much more intimately than me speak about this, and none of them are putting bets on what the shape will be. I think there is potential for a radicalisation of British politics to the left and to the right, and one doesn't know where that pendulum will eventually swing towards. And depending on where it swings, I think to do with Brexit, remarkably, after all this time, every option is still potentially open. I think the more probable options are a Conservative government or a Conservative Brexit Party alliance that wants to get out as soon as possible and to get on to the next phase. It is an illusion to talk about bringing Brexit to a close. The disengagement or divorce is the first part of a two-act drama, of which typically with the EU, Act Two is radically more complicated than our unprecedented experience with Act One, which is so-called Article 50. You send your letter of divorce in and you have 2 years to sort it out. That's one option. The other option, of course, if there was a Labour Party-dominated administration, either single party or coalition of some sort, Mr Corbyn appears to want to negotiate a not a Tory Brexit, whatever that detail would be, and therefore to want to change some things. probably meaning a softer Brexit than anticipated by Boris Johnson at present. And at the limit, it is possible that you could have a coalition elected or a party elected that, in the context of some new deal, would offer people a second plebiscite, a new referendum, which itself could produce its own confusions or its own certainty. And frankly, as we speak here today, all of those things are open. When the colleagues from the Irish consulate here were in touch with me to come here, I think they thought and I thought and perhaps you thought that finally a Rubicon would have been crossed on this and we would talk with some certainty, but it remains still as uncertain as before.
And just taking some of the hypotheticals then, there's obviously been a big sort of backlash against Brexit in the UK. There's been an upswing in love for the EU, people wearing berets with the EU flag, the sort of thing that would have been unimaginable in the UK before Brexit. And I think there's an assumption from the Remain campaign that if there was a referendum and they won, that the EU would embrace the UK back. I mean, do you think that view is correct if by some sort of degree of events, some circumstances happen that allow this referendum, there's a win, would the EU say, fine, you can come back, Britain, we're friends again? Or have things changed anyway and in some sort of irrevocable way?
Not yet is the answer to that. I think the correct answer would be, as a European posture, should the possibility come about that Britain would change its mind, I think the European Union would accept that and move on. I think the more difficult question is whether a fractured British polity and political system and society could accept it. I think the European Union could accept it. And I think the European Union consistently has expressed itself as regards Brexit with a sense of regret, but resignation, if that is the British choice. But I think they would be happy to step back. Donald Tusk, who chairs the European Council, has been the most explicit along the way in saying to the British that he hoped they would change their mind. I think that hope stroke optimism has dissipated somewhat, but I think it does represent an underlying understanding. I think, fair to say for most Europeans, not for all, that Brexit is a lose-lose circumstance. Britain loses, European Union loses, and lose-lose is bad.
And let's take the other, perhaps more likely hypothetical, that Brexit goes ahead in some guise, either under Conservative government or a Labour government. How is the EU going to approach sort of the next stage, if you like, if and when the divorce is finally agreed? What's the EU's view on how to build the next sort of phase, the building of a future relationship, and what does the EU want to achieve from that process?
The next phase is covered in Eurospeak in a thing called the political declaration. So you've a withdrawal agreement, which is the terms of disengagement, which has been stuck between gears in the House of Commons, and then you have attached to it a political declaration on future relations. That is not legally binding. The withdrawal agreement is. And the political declaration is a declaration of intent of what the two sides would like to happen. So everyone in the United Kingdom has said, and Mrs. May said it, and it has been repeated by Boris Johnson, quote, we are leaving the European Union, but we're not leaving Europe. So the issues of security, defence, justice, anti-terrorism, sharing of information, innovation policy, environment policy, etc. All those things are there and could change, but both sides in principle would like to consolidate a strong and stable relationship around them. The bit that is going to be quite tricky, and it's not to say all those things don't have their challenges, is the new trade relationship. And in essence, I think, this, by the way, to explain, in the EU, we've never had a country that left, so we're all learning by doing. But the procedure for leaving is that once you leave, you become, quote, a third country. So you're another country outside the Union. And that triggers the possibility then and only then that the EU could begin to negotiate a trade relationship with the third country, which in this case is the United Kingdom. And they have provided in the withdrawal agreement for a transition period. And that period will last in the current form until the end of December of 2020. Assuming that the disengagement happened, for the sake of argument, an assumption that is heroic in the context of experience, and assuming that by the end of next January, the first part was done, it seems to me improbable that you would have a deal finished by the end of that year. There is no precedent of any free trade deal being negotiated by the European Union that ever finished in under 1 year. In fact, I would scratch my head to see if I could find a precedent for something that finished in under 5 years, and I could point to quite a few that did finish in under 10 years. So something new will come up in the next few months, not unlike the slipping deadlines for the disengagement process. And that is that by next summer, in June, if the two sides think they don't have enough time, they're going to have to negotiate an extension of the transition period. And if it begins to sound familiar, I think of it like rethreading a tire. So Brexit is not going away anywhere fast or soon to do with all of these things. There will be a rethread of the same tire, which will have to go through so many revolutions again on the transition period. And then comes the bottom line. I can say to you, even though it's put in a very general way, what the EU would like on the future trade relationship is no tariffs, no quotas, and no dumping. And the last one is the hard bit, because in principle, it could be possible to close a deal with Britain quickly, because at the point of departure, the two entities are convergent. British law is European law to do with all of those things. So the critical issue, depending again on the election result, is what will the winners want in the United Kingdom as regards future potential divergence of rules? And what we can conclude before it ever starts is the greater the alignment of the rule book, the greater the free and untrammeled access of trade in goods and services. And the less the alignment or its trajectory over time, the less the access. And this is a very open question, because Boris Johnson deconstructed Mrs. May's space and may have, I hypothesize here, I have no evidence of this, may have bought some of what the Financial Times called the Brexit Bolsheviks on board his plan, precisely because he sold them some new global Britain unchained concept behind closed doors. Because his deal, although it is different than Northern Ireland and how it operates, is essentially Mrs. May's deal with a different protocol on Northern Ireland. And there are some changes to the political declaration that water it down a bit, but it's essentially the same deal. So, to use the Financial Times phrase, because of the ideology in it, why would the Brexit Bolsheviks have come on side with Boris Johnson and not with Mrs. May? Well, you could say he was the leader of the Leave campaign and so on. But my guess is that a nod is as good as a wink, as people tell, and there's been some nodding and winking going on in private that we can't see, but if we're not entirely stupid, we might guess.
So the Brexit vortex is about to get even more complex and painful as it sucks Britain in. But I guess for the British people, they chose this, right, democratically, first through electing a government on a manifesto to hold a referendum and then by voting in the referendum. I want to ask you a bit about the implications for Ireland, where obviously you've probably been the country, definitely been the country most impacted, but obviously had no say. It's a different country. It wasn't part of the referendum. I mean, how much oxygen has Brexit been consuming in the political space, in the media in Ireland? Because certainly in the UK, it's been consuming all of it. In the rest of the EU, a lot less so. It's been sort of drifting off the front pages. But how about for Ireland?
For Ireland, it is a front page constant story filled with angst. And it has, in a certain way, I think, to do with strategic politics and diplomacy, has entombed our leadership politically and diplomatically in a Brexit sarcophagus. I think they would like to push the lid off and see what's the light of day like at the end of it all. We have two major strategic interests. The one is the bit that has been so far well rehearsed, which is the island of Ireland, the absence of a border, the respect for the Belfast Agreement, and the ability of the Republic of Ireland to cleave to its full membership of the EU, which it values. The other part, the other major strategic interest, is we have trade interests. And the United Kingdom is our largest single trading partner within the firmament of the EU single market. And the downside economic risks for Ireland are very high, with significant implications for growth, for employment, and especially for the largest indigenous industry, which is food, agriculture, and beverages. And so we still haven't gone through all of that. And because there's so much at stake to do with the strategic economic part yet to come, and there was so much at stake and still is to do with the all-island part and the east-west dimensions of that is not just north-south dimensions, this has been a source of obsessive interest, of constant angst, and of a very interesting element in Irish politics. We have in Ireland a hyper-minority government. I think at its peak between the main party of government, which is Fine Gael, and independents who are aligned with the government, I think they had 58 seats in a parliament of 158. And so they've relied on a supply and confidence agreement with the main opposition party, Fianna Fáil. And greatly to their credit, because in politics, as you well know, it's a contested business. And people like to play percentages. And in Britain, part of that has managed to avoid the capacity to build a consensus across parties. In Ireland, we've had a total national consensus on this question, notwithstanding the hyper-minority government that is there. And I think it is a great credit to the maturity of both government and opposition that they have understood that the stakes are so high that we cannot play politics in the usual argy-bargy, Punch and Judy type contest that you can get, and really that we've got to row in the same direction, same boat, at the same time.
And you talked about the stakes being so high, but can you explain a bit more about why avoiding a hard border between Northern Ireland, part of the United Kingdom, and the rest of the Republic of Ireland, why is that so important that it's driven this sort of rare consensus in Irish politics?
There's a very high level, firstly, of day-to-day interaction across the border before we complicate it up with Brexit. When I was a younger man, so around your age, let us say, I was an academic, and I would go regularly to Northern Ireland and would bring my family. And a lot of my neighbours thought I was slightly mad. You know, why are you going up there and why are you taking the risk? And this was at the time when, of course, unhappily, there was a very active terrorist campaign. But of course, when you went to Northern Ireland, you realised people don't have two heads. They're perfectly decent and ordinary people, and some extraordinary and bad things are happening there. And when I would pass the border, it was always a moment of some angst. You would have armed guards, normally British soldiers. You would have big concrete bollards on the road and you would zigzag your way in. And as you got into the middle of the zigzag, you would open the boot. They would put mirrors underneath to see if there's any bombs and so on. they would ask to see your documentation. Your kids would be straining their necks like turkeys for Christmas out the window to see what's going on. And all of these things were happening. And if you happened to want to bolt for it, there was a great big piece of zigzag iron with nails sticking out that would burst your tires instantly, and maybe something more dramatic would happen. You're held from watchtowers with machine guns and lights in them. And this is what we crossed. After the Belfast Peace Agreement, all that went away. And so if I brought you from my home in Dublin to Belfast, which is the nearest city in Ireland to where I live, we would drive for about an hour and three quarters, I guess, but an hour and three quarters of a trip. If I didn't tell you, you wouldn't know you were in Northern Ireland on the motorway. Except I know because our road signs on the motorway are in blue and theirs, paradoxically, are in green. And ours are in kilometres and theirs are in miles. Or if you have a phone, you will get a little beep to tell you that your supplier, Vodafone or someone, is now UK and not Ireland. But other than those things, it's not at all obvious. Then we have students who cross back and forth. We have people in Donegal who go to Alna Gelvin Hospital in Derry. We have an all-island electricity market. We do our tourism marketing for the whole island, our inland waterway system, the whole island. All of that stuff is there. Who needs a border when we built all those things to try to construct a better way of living together in harmony and with consensus to do with the high politics? And then there is, not to be exaggerated but not to be ignored, the latent security threat, which is acknowledged by the security services on both sides of the border and which unhappily reared its ugly head in the past 12 months with various incidents. And there was, I would say, an absolute certainty that if you put a border post in the classic sense on key border crossings, that not because you want it, but it's the unintended consequence that you may get that becoming the target for a new wave of terrorism, which has no foundation to do with public preference, but still has hard people willing to play that game. And this was a huge fear. And you can read from the Police Service of Northern Ireland, from the Garda Síochána, the Police Service of the Republic of Ireland, some north-south bodies that we've got with diplomats on each side. These things are talked about a little bit sotto voce. You don't want to talk about something as risking to justify, but you do know the risk. And so it has been a sine qua non that we wanted a uniqueness for Northern Ireland in the departure of the United Kingdom, to recognise the uniqueness of the circumstances on the island of Ireland. And that word unique appeared in the first resolution of the European Parliament as regards Ireland, 7 days after Mrs. May lodged the Article 50 notification. And the European Parliament resolution was the first official document yet before the heads of government and state through the European Council or others to actually detail what would be looked at. So the EU looked for three things in the disengagement agreement: citizens' rights, British citizens in EU states, EU citizens in United Kingdom. They looked for the financial settlement, which, by the way, is not a divorce bill. It's the money that you owe to the budget that you've already agreed to, but it's not always drawn down up front. It's drawn down over time as it's required. And the final thing, but the most difficult thing, was the Irish border question and what to do with that. Mrs. May had a plan. In December of 2017, having submitted in March of that year her disengagement notification, she went to Brussels to have lunch with Jean-Claude Juncker, the president of the European Commission. And what they were contemplating was a settlement for Northern Ireland where the east-west, so the Northern Ireland to UK space, would be the point at which or through which any checking or border requirements would happen. And she got a telephone call during the lunch and had to step out. And her interlocutor on the phone was Mrs. Arlene Foster, the leader of the Ulster Democratic Unionist Party, from a space whose majority had voted to stay in the EU, saying that this settlement, because of its uniqueness, was absolutely unacceptable. And so there was a lot of kerfuffle between the beginning of December and the European Summit meeting in the middle of December, when Mrs. May came with a new British offer. And that offer was to say, actually, we've changed our mind about this East-West sea business. We will allow all of the United Kingdom to remain in the European Customs Union until we find a way to avoid the Irish border question being a problem. And so we developed this language, the backstop would be there unless and until something better came. And that was the deal that Mrs. May faced a Tory rebellion on, which she won, a Labour motion of no confidence on, which she won, which she then took to Parliament in January of 2018, where she lost by the biggest margin in the history of the House of Commons. And it came back on three subsequent occasions. She lost by less on each occasion, but did lose. She then wanted to bring it for the first time across the floor to the opposition, and the opposition and herself couldn't agree, perhaps never would have agreed, and then she drew the conclusions and stepped down. Now, the interesting thing, on the EU side, the Council, which is the heads of government and state, the European Parliament and the European Commission were fully coordinated, coherent and consistent. And so Mrs. May was one state negotiating with one agent for 27 states, whose agency was completely coherent and consistent. And she was leading a divided cabinet, facing a divided parliament, in a divided country, with a sharply divided commentariat. And she was uniquely weak as compared with her counterpart. And in any negotiation, Brexit, anything else, is not a great way to play your hand when you're visibly weakened by your internal divisions and your counterpart is wholly coherent and consistent and united among themselves.
And looking out at the bigger picture, I mean, do you think in some senses that Brexit could be a catalyst for the eventual unification of Ireland, that the sort of the strange place it's going to find itself in will, you know, push the argument further that it makes much more sense for the island to be fully integrated as one?
You asked the question in a very hold-all way, could it be? Well, the answer is yes, it could. Do I think on the balance of probabilities it's something going to happen pretty soon? I think the answer is no. There are voices in Ireland say it should happen. But if I go back to the Belfast Agreement, which really has mattered a lot in this conversation, this is now part of the Irish Constitution. We used to have a claim in our Constitution to the 32 counties of the island of Ireland, and we dropped, by an overwhelming vote in 1999 after the Belfast Agreement, we dropped the territorial claim and we replaced it in effect with a hearts and minds claim. In other words, if this ever happens, it can only happen by consensus. And it seems to me the precursor to your question being fulfilled, should it be fulfilled? It has to happen through votes and so on, but should it be fulfilled? I think it requires a lot of work in advance. What you don't want is a form of Irish nationalist majoritarianism replacing what used to be for some decades Ulster Unionist majoritarianism in Northern Ireland. We've learned the lessons that majoritarianism kills people. And so we've got to find a way to build more complex consensus. And one thing we got good at in Ireland to do with our internal referenda in Republic of Ireland is preceding sensitive, culturally sensitive referenda with citizens' assemblies and ventilating issues through the citizens' assembly and then bringing it back into our parliamentary committees and re-ventilating it, guided by the wisdom of the citizens' assembly, and then putting it to the people. And we've done some interesting things with referenda that if you asked me as a younger man some years ago, would it happen, I would have thought it was highly unlikely without dramatic culture wars, and we managed to de-escalate them. So I think we need a long process of de-escalating potential future ticking bombs, if I might say it in the political sense, if we're to do this. Is it doable? Certainly it is. Is it imminent? I think certainly it's not. And the official position, of the Irish Taoiseach leading the government is exactly the space I've described, that imminence is not there, but the perspective, of course, for some time, somehow, could be there.
It's interesting that people in the UK have started talking about citizens' assemblies, but I think it's a bit late in the context of that referendum, which is long gone. And in the Irish case, so you have to do them beforehand, not afterwards. But moving on to the future of the EU after Brexit, if and when it happens, obviously the EU, as you were saying earlier, has been quite united in the face of Brexit. And it's something, the shared challenge of dealing with Britain has brought us togetherness. If and when Britain leaves, do you think that cohesiveness holds, or is there a risk that the solidarity weakens once you don't have this same strong common challenge?
I think it depends on the policy area, and frankly, it's a bit diverse, is the truth. I think the coherence about the Brexit part was an understanding that, and this happens in institutions over all human history, that things can be strong, but like a coin, if you flick them, can be fragile in other circumstances. And so the realization of potential fragility, the domino effect, etc., caused European leaders, whatever other strains they have, and you know they can be enumerated, to understand that this was one area where you hang together or you hang separately. And it was a very important lesson. And we've seen in public opinion polls that public opinion within EU member states towards the EU itself and their membership of EU has shot up. Because there was an understanding that, frankly, day by day as things goes on, you can mumble and groan and complain. And then when you're confronted, actually, maybe that thing could be in trouble. It was a bit of a wake-up call. And the wake-up was there's something of value here and it needs to be protected and it needs to be nurtured. So that has been the reaction. I think what will happen, and this will take time to evolve, the United Kingdom played a strong role in the EU, and indeed British diplomacy would get an A grade for its quality in looking after Britain's interests and in promoting Britain's values in and through the EU. So for example, when Mrs. May wanted to deal with the shocking killing of Mr. Skripal by the Russians, she came straight to the EU to look for the first line of defence, which was about sanctions, because it was the natural place to do it, with like-minded people. So these easy points of access and amenity will be diminished, could be destroyed, I hope they're not. And in the case of Britain, its orientation towards competitiveness, towards open markets, towards liberal trade policies, all these things have mattered, and greatly to my own country, to Ireland. And so a lot of Scandinavians, the Dutch, the Irish, feel a little bit of anxiety. You know, are we going to have to kind of muscle up a bit to stay in the groove that we're comfortable with? And then you have, within the Union, you've had, of course, a very strong Franco-German alliance from the beginning. But among the larger states, Britain was kind of mediating, was a player in that space. So when you pull it out, there's a vacuum in that space. And so, in principle, Italy, a very large state, a founder member, could play a key role. But it has been very consumed with its necessary introspection on its economy and the migration crisis in Italy. France and Germany do play a role. They've renewed the Elysee Treaty and so on. But they have been, in a certain way in recent years, out of synchronization. President Hollande was politically out of synchronization with Mrs. Merkel. President Macron, who's now the player, is the one with all the appetite for more dramatic change. And Mrs. Merkel is approaching the twilight of her period in office. And so the absence of synchronicity creates a bit of a problem around that. But for the EU, there are immediate things. The EU has to agree its budget for the next number of years, and that isn't settled. So that's an in-house form of, dare I say, it's a bit dramatic, but kind of political cannibalism. Everyone wants to cannibalize the other guy's share of a budget or the other guy's input or whatever in order to optimize their own net take. something which is alien in principle to how the budget is constructed, but widely used in practice. The second dimension which needs to be looked at is filling the gaps from the lessons that we learned from the Eurozone crisis. That crisis has gone away, but some of the structural flaws remain to be addressed. And they're not going to be easily addressed, but they're still there, and there's a momentum towards that. The new European institution, the new Commission, is due to take over, a new president of the European Council. We just elected a new European Parliament. Without any doubt, they're going to radically intensify Europe's determination on an EU scale to be the first global region committed to net zero emissions by 2050, and to drive and deepen all of the stuff to do with that. Then we've all of the sensitivities about security and defence. We saw Monsieur Macron's recent statement that NATO was brain dead. He got, do you say in a somewhat sexist way, when Mrs. Thatcher held her line, that she belted people with her handbag, which I thought was quite a sexist thing, but that was so many years ago, maybe you get away with it. Mrs. Merkel doesn't appear to carry a handbag, but if she had one, she belted Mr. Macron with it and said, this won't do. Mrs. von der Leyen, the former defense minister of Germany, who is now the president-elect of the incoming European Commission, has Mrs. Merkel's line. And I've absolutely no doubt, if you go to Central Eastern Europe, especially to Poland and the Baltic states, there is no way they will want to see a diminution of NATO. I think what Mr. Macron's words do show an impatience that he wants to see Europe begin to develop its own strategic doctrine. And this is not about, you know, do you break away from NATO and so on, but an understanding that unhappily some of the great certainties that we had, and that perhaps you've had in Australia, about the United States as a source of continuity in alliances, predictability in foreign policy and strategy, seems to be evaporating before our eyes. And that is a source of genuine worry across the European Union, and especially so when we see Russian revanchism of the sort we saw in Crimea, or the 13,000 dead in Donbass, or the 1.5 million Ukrainians displaced because of it. This is very disquieting. And then if we add to it more to do with your regional intimacy than ours, but our biggest trading partner like yours is China. And we have developed now an understanding that we want a strong, positive relationship with China, but that we've understood it's also a strategic competitor. And the language of being a strategic competitor is now the official language of the European Union. We tiptoed around it before, but some mornings now we wake up and we discover that Beijing is sitting down with its BRI initiatives, the Belt and Road initiatives, with 18 member states of the Union. Now, at one level, you may have some anxieties already about the territorial nature, but at another level, to do with rules like labour market, transparency, state aid policy, etc., there's a lot of opaqueness there. And the EU at its last summit meeting with China put all this stuff on the table and said, we've got to sort this stuff out. So all of those elements are there and need in European foreign policy a more muscular appreciation. But we would like to see still, to do it the way we do business as a union, a multipolar world, and not to slip in just to some very large players that suck everyone along in their wake. Realpolitik, I understand, but you need to locate yourself in that firmament. Where does your needle stop on that radar screen in terms of locating strategic interest and capacity?
And before, I'm going to open up the floor in a second, but before we do, I want to ask you a really broad question about the future of the EU. I mean, you mentioned Mr. Macron's interview with The Economist, where he also said that if the EU can't turn itself into a unified global power, European nations risk losing their sovereignty, effectively, as Russia and China perhaps cut them off, the US withdraws and they can't rely on that crutch. So he's saying without more ever closer union, European nations lose their sovereignty. But contrast to that, Mark Rutte, the Dutch PM, sat here about a month ago and gave a speech, and he said sort of the exact opposite, that ever closer union is a sort of meaningless statement, an acronym can't have a soul or a destiny, this is just a waste of time, this is nonsense. So you know, you've got the Dutch leader saying one thing, and he obviously represents, you know, views of quite a few others. You have Macron there, and others sort of have sympathy with him. How does the EU play out these differences over where it should go in the future? Do you have to end up effectively with a kind of two-speed Europe and a more integrated core and a second rim around that? How is the EU actually going to move forward on these integration questions with such kind of deep philosophical divides?
Well, firstly, none of this is new. All of this is as old as the EU. And so the fact that it's still there and all those things are all still there speaks to resilience. And so the first thing I would say, if you're looking at the EU with all of its imperfections, do not underestimate the resilience and political will to keep it going. And this has been seen through the several crises that have been there, that resilience is a key thing. And when push comes to shove, people will find a way. This philosophical question of, you know, the more federalist European model, with federalism tending towards centralism, and the other kind of federalism, which is about subsidiarity and pushing things down, that's a constant. It is even in language terms in our treaties. I think the European Union, I have to give a personal opinion here, I think the European Union will not be best served by those who bring to the table a presumption of excessive perfectionism. And it will not be well served by those who bring to the table a practice of excessive populism. And so I think moderation in all things permits you to step forward. And ultimately, it is the moderate space that will out and find expression. I think it's important to understand when Mr. Macron uses the sovereignty term about Europe, the point is actually about the existing member states. What Mr. Macron is saying, and if you read his speeches, he's given many, but I think the one in September 2 years ago in La Sorbonne set it out in a big way. He's explaining to whoever listens that one by one, hence the risk of Brexit, states that presume tomorrow's world is like yesterday's world and you can stand out and do your own thing, in this new world, it doesn't work that way. And that there are some great powers and new great power tensions emerging, as we can see. And you have to find your space there. Not just a me too. And it has to be clever, because it may be me too, but. But you're looking to find your space. And Macron's view is, if we choose always, in the making of foreign policy, to privilege our bilateral preferences, we'll do what we want with the rest of the world, we're diminishing our ability to do things together that give us real muscle and strength. And this doesn't have to be muscle to do with hard power and its exercise or the projection of force. It's about the force of reason. And it's about the force of law through internationally binding treaties in a multilateral system that respects a rule of law process. And this is beginning to disintegrate before our eyes. And so these things really matter. And I think on this Macron is right, that if we want our states, I am an Irish European, but I'm Irish first and last. And as an Irish European, I want my state to prosper in this wider world. And we have understood as a small state that by pooling some of our sovereignty, we've added to our sovereignty. Whereas I think for many in the United Kingdom, the view was from the very beginning, by pooling some of their sovereignty, they diminished who they were. And these are two different universes. And Mr. Macron's universe in that sense is not quite unlike Ireland. I don't talk of NATO and so on. That is the sense that some things that you do together make you stronger. So for example, when we do a trade deal, we don't do it as Ireland or Hungary or Denmark. We do it as the European Union. We do it with only 7% of the global population, but with 16.6% of the global GDP. And so we have a real card to play in our collective interest, stronger than the lesser cards we could each play if we were disintegrated and working one by one bilaterally. And in that sense, Mr. Macron has his finger on a pulse of sorts. The question is to calibrate the language and not to frighten the children or the horses in Poland or whatever it might frighten.
Okay, and now it's your turn to ask questions. Who wants to go first? And if you could tell us who you are and your affiliation, if you have one.
McGregor from Lowy. Somebody's tried to follow Brexit but given up periodically. What did the EU give Boris Johnson that it wouldn't give Theresa May, which allowed him to strike this last-minute deal? Or is it a form of smoke and mirrors? I couldn't quite understand what he got that she couldn't.
Richard, that's a great question. And the answer is they gave him nothing that she couldn't have. I will leave it, forgive me if I make it really simple, because the stuff is too complicated sometimes to follow easily. I mentioned earlier that Mrs. May had lunch in Brussels in December of 2017. She was coming to do a unique deal for Northern Ireland as the rest of the UK moved out and moved on. And it was stopped by the Democratic Unionist Party, whose vote she needed in Parliament. Boris Johnson, who in seeking to get elected as Tory leader and who at different party conferences, including at the DUP's party conference last year, went and said, you know, over his dead body, would stuff like that ever happen, that Northern Ireland was absolutely to be treated the same way as everything else, actually came to the conclusion after this year's Tory conference conveniently was out of the way, that that was the solution he wanted. So we went back, kind of, I mean, there are little details, but essentially to something similar to what Theresa May would have had, but in the end chose not to look for. And loosely, because again, the language is a bit wide of the mark, we ended up again with a front stop, the sea east-west, versus the backstop, which would have been the border north-south or the fear of it. So it's pretty well Mrs. May's deal, Mark One, recycled. There are two differences then with Mrs. May's deal. Britain is no longer committed to remain for a foreseeable future in the customs union, which was her formula to avoid the border and to accept the backstop. And they added in a principle of consent, where the Northern Ireland Assembly, by a majority, will need to vote some years into this to sustain it, and then, you know, on cycles of potential votes every so many years later. To do with the complexities of it, you know, what forms do you fill and what VAT do you pay, value-added tax, and what excise, and what rules of origin do you apply, and what standards do you have for phytosanitary conditions for animals passing back and forth, etc. It's hellishly complicated. I counted last night, in case someone would ask the question, there are 44 pages of regulatory references attached to the protocol on Northern Ireland, with a promise to set up a joint committee between the UK and the EU, because obviously any sensible person asked the question, what does that mean? Probably couldn't answer it. So some poor guy, or guys, or men or women, are going to be stuck scratching their heads and filling out the details. So there's currently a debate, because Mr. Johnson a few days ago was talking to people in Ulster, telling them how they won't have to fill forms and so on. That would seem to me to be a little bit on the premature side when I looked at the 44 pages in Annex to do with the technical requirements.
He almost certainly has not looked at the 44 pages in the Annex, you'd imagine.
No, in fact, Mr. Farage is challenging him to a debate because Mr. Farage feels he has looked at that and has found succour as devil in the detail.
Okay, yeah, up front.
Thank you, Mr. Cox. I think you explained a lot of things both to me and I'm sure to my colleagues here, and I thank you very much for it. When we get back to the original...
Do you want to tell us who you are and if you have an affiliation?
Andrew Watson, sole operator from Coogee.
Okay.
When the referendum came out, I think it was 51.7, 48.3, roughly there, which I regard as a clear mandate. The complexities and problems that have risen since that time, do you believe it's because they didn't think it would get across the line, there would be a Brexit, or they didn't have the mechanical systems in place as to how to go and achieve that? Because it's been going on for months and months and months and months, and I'm really quite disappointed with the length of time the people in Brussels making deals, and this when I said to my friends, they want to leave, rightly or wrongly, they want to leave.
Mm.
And my final point is I think the tactics of Boris Johnson, I'd have a nice little wager on him in the forthcoming general election that he'll put Jeremy to the sword very convincingly. And will that elimination of the lunatic left allow the process to take place as it was designed in the first place?
I'll start with your last word, design. The British Constitution, as you know, is unwritten and it relies on convention and practice to see it through over a very long period of time. And it is not a polity practiced in plebiscitary democracy. Its first full referendum in its history was in 1975, when Harold Wilson took over government and decided that he would put the question of being in the EEC again so he could do his deal and stamp his authority. And that overwhelmingly passed in a British environment, although there was a divided debate, where the media were largely on side and the public were largely on side. The David Cameron choice was discretionary and not mandatory. There was no change in an EU treaty because with the Liberal Democrats, they passed a law, the EU Act, that said if the EU changes the treaty, we have to have a referendum in Britain. But even though he'd passed the Act to kind of choke off the Farage flank and his own Bolsheviks, it wasn't enough. And so he decided he would promulgate the idea of having a referendum. My guess is he probably thought he wouldn't win a majority at the next election and the Lib Dems or someone in coalition would block him. And lo and behold, he won a majority. And so he brought forward the referendum. And this was a discretionary act. The second element in this was that the referendum asked a simple question, clear. It was like a road sign at a crossroads. Remain is that way, leave is that way. And you're correct, 52 to 48 in round terms. On a good turnout, 72%, because they don't have compulsory voting, so that's a very high turnout. People say, yeah, we'll go that way. But it didn't say what was the destination. You know, are you going out to the northern suburbs or are you going up to Darwin? Where are you going? It didn't say. And so it fell to representative democracy to try to figure out what is the destination. We know we're leaving. But leaving could be we're leaving the political institutions, but like Norway, staying in the European single market because it's to our benefit. Or it could mean, no, we don't want to be like Norway, but like Turkey, we could be in a customs union.
So you're saying they actively didn't think of these?
The Treasury did some fantastic work, which was dismissed as Project Fear by a very populist campaign. Basically, the campaign, I would say, I mean, to reduce it down, consisted on one side, the Remain side, of economism, and on the other side of identity politics. And identity politics won. Immigration issues and take back control and so on. And so once you knew you voted for a direction, and I do insist, I mean, this was the conundrum, they hadn't voted the destination. The sign didn't say, you go that way and you stop at such a place 50 kilometres down the road. So it fell to representative democracy to figure out what the hell does this mean. Now, in my view, in a 52-48 situation, the ideal condition would be to create a grand parliamentary committee and to sit like so many clucking hens until you hatch an egg. But they didn't do that. they decided, you know, they would do their own thing. And so you had a divided parliament that never created the consent tool bridge, a divided cabinet which struggled to find consensus, and an increasingly fractious and divided society to do with the question. And this is not the EU's doing. The EU was locked and loaded and ready to go with the negotiations, but cannot force feed the British into making one choice or another choice. We have to live with the consequences of the sovereign choice that Britain chooses to make, but it has to make its own choices. Do they want the Norway model? Do they want the Turkey model? Do they want a Canada model? Do they want something bespoke? Remember, the House of Commons at one stage had these indicative votes. They voted on 8 options and had a majority on none. So there was inertia, whole and complete. And that is not the fault of the European Union. That was a British incapacity to decide. And in a paper I wrote a few years back in 2016, weeks after the election, I quoted David Cameron's first speech to the House of Commons. You will find, if you check the Jean Monnet website, a copy of that paper delivered to a summer school in Ireland. And in it, I quote David Cameron's first speech in the Parliament to say, we're going to create this Brexit department, and we're going to put all the brightest and the best and good in there. And I'm using my words, and we're going to figure out what to do. I said, my God. Imagine you were driving a car, it turns out, with the window blackened, your foot to the accelerator, and you didn't know, you know, where you were driving. And so, to be honest with you, to do with all the things that we associate with Britain historically, to do with coherence, capacity, diplomatic ability, strategic focus, etc., this has been a shock for them, but for all of their friends and allies, an utter shock as well. And so I think it has already debilitated the standing of the United Kingdom. And then, forgive me, on other stuff, I have a kind of a feeling that a lot of this, you know, Project Fear and not facing up to some of the facts that were there was a bit like Hans Christian Andersen's Emperor with No Clothes. And so it got a nice new Armani suit, and it was called Global Britain. And Global Britain had a nice crease in its trousers, and it could go out there on the global stage and return and rediscover the Commonwealth and so on. The Commonwealth, you'll know better in this institute than me, but it is 53 or 54 states. It has a population of 2.4 billion, I think. Slightly more than half of them live in India. Let me tell you a thing about India and Ireland. Ireland has a population republic of 4.75 millions. According to official documentation, heard in evidence, based on official published British trade statistics to a House of Commons committee, which you can find on the web and check, the Republic of Ireland purchased 475% of the value of India from Great Britain in the last full round of trade, and Ireland even bought more than the People's Republic of China from Great Britain. To do with gravity flow, culture, preference, taste, ease of access, etc. So all this stuff about Global Britain, when I come down to those numbers, it makes no sense to me. But that is anyway a British question, not an Irish question, and we have to see how that cookie crumbles.
I think we're almost out of time, but I just want to end by asking you one broad question. I mean, you talked earlier about, you know, a strategic EU taking its place at the world table. I mean, can you see that happening in the next 10 years, the next 20 years, the EU turning its economic power into real strategic, even military power on the world stage?
Military power, I would have a big question mark, because the debate to do with the military part partly straddles the debate to do with, like, federalist or not. I'm not imminently expecting a European army, although it's talked about kind of a lot. But if you had one, would it be a European army or an army of Europeans? Because those are two very different things. The army of Europeans is people put their hand up and say, yes, we'll send in a contingent, a battalion, whatever, to assist something. I think if we go down that road, we're more likely to be the army of Europeans than the European army. So that's one sense. I think the other issues to do with the soft power stuff, the genuine belief in multilateralism and the genuine belief that we need to do things together. I hope also with Australia on that kind of front to understand that we have skin in that game, and the more it's just a big boy's game and anyone else gets stepped on, requires the rest to wake up to the need for engaged and open and active multilateralism with rules of engagement and clear rules of the game. I think Europe can be a power and a strength there regionally and can carry that into its global arrangements. And I think, sensitive as I understand these things can be in so many different jurisdictions, I think getting real on climate is going to be one of the great political causes of the immediate coming years. And I think the European Union will be determined in all sorts of ways to seek to put its own thumbprint and even footprint into that space, including in its future trade deals. And I know we've now started the negotiations with Australia, and these will run their course and take their time. And the one thing I would point out, however long it takes and so on, I think there is a real mutual interest here. The EU states, as such, are not the investor, but EU companies are the largest source today of FDI in Australia. Your trade with Europe has often used Great Britain as a gateway. That gateway to do with EU may be fully open or only slightly open in the future, so people need to think through the implications. And I think to do some of these things I've talked about, strengthening the WTO, having effective multilateralism, these matter to Australia. And so I think we can kind of gang up a little bit together to do some of those things. And I'm really hoping we will do it. And in the end of the day, with trade deals in particular, to underline, every parliament in the EU has a vote. Everyone. The European Parliament, but every national parliament. Because they stray into areas beyond the strict competence of the EU. And your system is that your parliament, after due inquiry and work done by some of your joint committees, will get to vote on any trade deal. So it has ultimately a democratic verification and mandate. So I think we should really hit that accelerator and go for it as hard as we can and as fast as necessary, while always understanding there are complexities to be dealt with. And thank you very much for the wonderful opportunity to speak to you today.